Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community. Plus, a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's April 23rd, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Ostrom. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform, just head over to cloudposse.com/meet, answer a quick question, and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? Real easy. Just engage as much as you'd like, unmute yourself if you're muted. If you have any questions and you can't unmute, you can post them in the chat and we'll answer them that way. We'll also be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel, which is at youtube.com/meet. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. youtube.com/cloudposse. And yeah, if you are listening to this recording and you want to join us live, just go to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. So let's see what I got. So this first one looked interesting. GitHub, I didn't realize this was this is in GA now, so this must have been available for some time as a preview. Hadn't had a chance to check it out yet. I know we've talked about some other startups or security companies focused on GitHub Actions security specifically. I think one of them was involved with uncovering the TJ Actions changed files. A supply chain attack that happened a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago. So I'm curious, A, would this also have caught it? Have you seen any press about that? And then has anyone tried it? I haven't taken a look at it yet. So I'm not sure exactly what's involved with setting it up. If you have to install an action or it's just a toggle in the UI. Oh, you just add this line here, I think. So how that works, I believe, then, so if you go to GitHub, caps lock, github.com. Cloud Posse Atmos. So we're running CodeQL in Atmos. I think it was RB who contributed this. Thinking it was related to this maybe, but this wasn't pointing out languages. This is saying something about query, so not sure. I think it's related to this CodeQL init action, maybe, yeah, enabling some other additional packs here and stuff. Anyone have more experience working with this? CodeQL in general?
I'm not quite sure how to help you with that.
Thanks, Echo or Alexa. All right, next announcement. This was a sad one to see. WeWork's had to close their doors. What was it, the end of last year or something, or beginning of the year? They were the makers of Flux, a very popular GitOps solution. They basically invented or coined, I believe, the term GitOps. Earthly, I think they were one of the first movers in this space of local CI. We talked about it a little bit last week. I think DHH had a post on it. We talked about that, local machines have gotten fast enough. There's no performance reason not to run them locally necessarily. There can be other reasons, security, accessibility, network issues that you need to run things remotely, but performance is not one of them. The other frustrating thing, right, for developers is, if you have to test your changes every time by commit and push, it's a very slow feedback cycle. So it's much easier to develop your CI pipelines. You can just do it locally. Earthly doubled down on that. They had a very nice solution. They They unfortunately they summarize it pretty well here under challenge number two, open source cannibalization. They made the open source too good, too free, that it undermined their commercial offer and didn't give companies a good reason to upgrade to their commercial offerings. And he admits it himself, right? You're like, I get it. I would have done the same if I were in my customer's shoes. So that is a, authentic message. So they're shutting down. All the open source project is going into maintenance mode. They are open to a community fork of the project. They're shutting down the cloud by July 16th, and they're redirecting to Dagger. Dagger is another startup in the same space that I believe is founded by one of the Docker founders, one of the original creators of Docker. And they have they're running workshops to help people rewrite their configs to Dagger. It is not a drop-in replacement, but is similar conceptually to what Earthly did. You might also another product in this category was HashiCorp's last open source project attempt, if you will. You'll notice that HashiCorp hasn't really started any new open source projects lately. I think the most recent one was Waypoint. Waypoint was turned into a strictly commercial offering, and there is no the open source project that was Waypoint is no more. So that is that. Anyone have commentary on this one? Nothing from you, Matt.
Sorry, double muted. I was saying the only thing I would comment on is that I really like I really like the idea of this where you can run the same code locally and in CI to accomplish your pipeline. I'm not sure anyone has quite nailed it yet, like how to do it, but I like the concept behind that idea because I think that having one way to do it locally and then having GitHub Actions that run to do things in the cloud are really hard to sort of like figure out when an issue happens. I mean, Ben on our team and I just spent an hour debugging something, and it turned out to be exactly that. Like a GitHub action was doing something differently than what we thought, than what we were doing locally, and therefore it was corrupting some output and yada yada yada. But like that, if we were running the same exact thing both locally and in the cloud, we would have realized immediately what the problem was. So it's just I feel like we just run into that kind of thing all the time. So I
Isn't
don't know
Docker
if.
containers supposed to solve that though, Matt?
Not really, because you don't really run everything like through a Docker container in all of your CI pipe. I mean, maybe like you could, that could be an implementation of it. I could say that, but that is not how most pipelines are
Yeah,
implemented, and
it
you don't have
was
the tooling to run it locally. So, yeah.
Sorry, it was a silly kind of rhetorical thing, and Dagger is trying to do that, right?
Yeah.
Dagger is trying to be container all the way, similar to Concourse CI, but I think it's much more earnest.
Yeah, I think that was my what I was alluding to when I said like no one has quite yet nailed it yet is I don't think that the way the Dagger is approaching it is quite the going to become the canonical way that you run these pipelines. So I hope someone comes up with it, but I don't think it we're there quite yet. But maybe they're moving towards that.
Yeah, I'm gonna
They just
try
need to
Dagger
pull through.
again. Oh, sorry, yeah, Eric.
I was just, yeah. For my sake, can they just add GH actions command, which just runs your GitHub action workflows locally, and we don't need a new system. It's good enough.
Yeah, that would be much better. But then you'd have to run it like in Docker, basically locally, so that it could. do all the setups and all
Well,
that
it
kind
would
of thing.
still each step would run whatever the step was. So the step, if the step is using such and such container, then it runs that container.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It would have to integrate with your local Docker in order to make that
Yeah,
happen.
true, 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 true. That would be true. Yeah. All right. Close that one. All right. Next one was NerdLog. You used to see these kinds of tools pop up all the time. Pre-Kubernetes era, I would say. This idea, like, I don't know if you guys remember, like, what was it, PSSH or parallel SSH, and commands that would go out SSH into a bunch of nodes in parallel and stream data or run commands in parallel. That was like the early stages. Probably still things that are being done a lot in data centers, I'm guessing, or on-prem. This was a nice little tool, like he says, inspired by Greylog or Kibana, and how they're visualizing this histogram based on a search pattern. And this, there's no server setup. This is literally just reading logs directly from the remote systems in parallel. And I'm guessing interweaving those based on timestamps. Next project was this. So this was one I was hoping, Matt, you could maybe chime in on and add a little bit of background to it. Not that you've seen this post, but I think that the area is something you might know a little bit more about. I was surprised to learn that the level of sophistication that went into this part of the product for TikTok. That they build their own virtual machine distributed via Webpack that is entirely obfuscated in a pretty sophisticated manner, so that they can, for multiple reasons. One is general obfuscation. Two is to push things out to the edge to reduce compute on their servers,
And
stream.
it's much harder to find the spyware.
Well, it could be that, but the technique is used by Cloudflare in their
Yeah, I know.
challenges. The techniques are used by apparently Google Analytics and other systems. And I was thinking to myself, so why? Well, okay, so there are two things. So the honest answer, if that was your only concern, was to get that low-level ability, then you could just use, I guess, WebAssembly. But the whole idea is to also have the obfuscation layer, and for that you can't use that apparently, and then you have to go with building a VM in pure JavaScript and distributing with Webpack. But anyways, I was yeah, it seemed pretty sophisticated to me. Any I don't know thing you could add to that or.
Yeah, I haven't read enough about what it's doing, but yeah, I mean, most people who are doing anything like that is basically it's all about reducing the bundle size, like down to be as small as you can so that it runs as quickly as you can, especially apps that are frequently updating themselves, or like they have frequent changes, because you're not caching, you're not caching that JavaScript like as long, right? You're busting the cache because you have like fingerprinted it with your builds or whatever. And a lot of these companies are releasing, tens of times per day to the, to production. Oftentimes with things like feature flagged off or whatever, but they're still doing tons and tons of production releases. So I would assume it has something to do with like trying to get their
That's
bundle
true.
sizes down, and because their caches are being busted very frequently. So
I did read that it was related to one of those things, pushing changes so frequently, and these JavaScript Webpack files don't have to be cached. What was the other one that you said there? Oh yeah. That it's easier to detect if something is attaching to the code itself, then stopping behavior or processing. And then the other one was making it very hard to build other systems in general that try and manipulate it.
Yeah,
So
that rapid.
more resistant to tampering, which I
I
could
know
tell.
there were some people who for a while were writing libraries to detect if like Grammarly was running on the site, and trying to stop it as an example, because of the nature of Grammarly, like it runs as a browser plugin and it gets access to all the text that you're typing and writing and everything. It's a way to like exfiltrate sensitive data that should otherwise not be able to be pulled out of the environment. So all of that data that you're working on could, in theory, be sent back to Grammarly. So, and there were other errors that Grammarly was reporting when certain things were locked down and it was preventing certain JavaScript functions from happening. They may have fixed it at this point. This goes back several years when I did this, but I know I participated with someone who was trying to write something similar where they could detect if like other plugins were loaded and hooked in and whether they could like stop those from being able to access like data on the page and all of that kind of thing. So it's pretty interesting that they would go that deep into running their own VM, which is kind of crazy.
Another post was interesting because I remember, I believe we've talked about Spiegel before. It's a self-hosted OCI container mirroring or proxy service that you can deploy in your Kubernetes clusters. And then your nodes will automatically pull their images through that, but it's a peer-to-peer model. So if any other nodes in the cluster have the images, it'll download it. It was an interesting story. This was trending on Hacker News. If you want to read the full thread there, there was actually an official response from Microsoft apologizing for the way it was handled and some things that they made some immediate changes to give proper attribution. So Microsoft created their own fork of this called PeerD because, according to Microsoft, when they had their talks with him, he said it was out of scope and that they probably wouldn't be supporting streaming of OCI images. I didn't know that was a thing you could do, but apparently that is. And him saying that was the trigger point, apparently, where they decided, I guess we're going to have to fork it. And you realize these are small autonomous teams within a large, enterprise behemoth like Microsoft. And they went and did it. So now there's two competing projects that more or less do the same thing, except for PeerD has that support for the streaming images that was a requirement apparently for Microsoft. There was also some poor handling of attribution in the source code and the license headers might have been changed, I think it was. But there were a few things. Both the maintainer here and others pointed out that, that's the thing. If you get an MIT license, A, don't be surprised if that happens. You're basically saying that that is permitted and tolerated, as much as it hurts that if it is done. So if you really don't want that, make sure you pick the better license. But also there were things, Microsoft could have done to just, continue to attribute where it came from.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't just use like Napster or LimeWire and go. I'm sure the source code for that's laying around somewhere. If you need like peer-to-peer file transfers, it seems like we solved this in the early 2000s.
Didn't we? Yeah.
Just run a bunch of these things that have OCI formatted files on them, and then run it, and all of a sudden now you have like a peer-to-peer OCI registry. It seems pretty easy.
Let's just do XDCC, go back to the IRC days.
think that's in the spirit of it, though. I think it was the peer-to-peer aspect. Well, I mean, it was XIRCD was, I guess it was peer-to-peer, wasn't it? The original implementations of peer-to-peer in a crude way.
Yeah, you could crudely do it.
Yeah, I remember those the network friends were setting up their IRC servers, connecting to the networks. All right. This was interesting in a few ways. So I'm not sure exactly what to make of this because if you go to the Pocket, which is a company, it's a there's a they have a separate product. And it seems like they use their product to create this product. So this could be, you know, a successful marketing ploy. Nonetheless, I thought it was interesting. It's capable to tear through your code base and generate a meaningful kind of documentation site on the code base, assuming, like, let's say you didn't have one, coming up with the mermaid diagrams or the relationships and so forth.
Yeah, I tried
So
this
I
out on Atmos. It's I
thought.
actually,
Oh, you did?
yeah, I did. I tried it with three or four different models. They all did different things. They
Okay.
all broke down Atmos in completely different ways.
Huh.
I was about to kick off the one for ChatGPT, the 4.1, but the most interesting one I think was I think I tried the one from Meta, the latest. I forget what that one's called again, but. Yeah, it broke everything down by usability, in fact. Whereas I think when I was using one of the more experimental ones like Qwen, it actually did it on a developer way of how a developer would look at the way that the project is laid out. So it's,
And
I
that
mean,
is
it's,
interesting because,
yeah.
like, for, take for example, Atmos. You know, it's a thoroughly documented tool, but the code base is not thoroughly documented for developers working on it. So it's an interesting side. You know, there's two sides of this, and I could see that'd be an interesting way to jumpstart maybe some of that developer-facing documentation.
Yeah. And I just looked at it. So it was Llama Maverick was the one that made it all about how you use it. And I actually went through and did almost just kind of a user only kind of approach. And looking at the other ones, I think it was I tried Moonshot AI, Agentica, and Qwen, and they all did developer facing versions of it, where it was more of a how would you go and look at the structure of the code and how it builds.
Makes sense. And yeah, so maybe you can show that to me offline. I'd be interested to
Oh
see
yeah,
what that
it's a
looks
neat framework. For anybody who looks at the Pocket, their main page, it is a really quick way to understand how you could modify your own tools. And I kind of like it. It's not going to do everything though.
like. Can you take a step back or no? Or the Pocket, though, weren't they building like some support platform or something?
They had well, this is part of their tutorial series, so if you just go to their root organization in GitHub, there's actually an explanation. They just have all the different sort of building blocks separated out for how you would prompt AI to do different things. And beyond that, I would say I can't explain it as well as their own website does, because they actually have working code demos. You can click links to get little, you know, try it out in your browser examples, and they show you how to write an agent, how to write an MCP piece. There's a Python version of it. There's a Golang version of it. I forget what other languages they support, but it's all just, you know.
And I remember we talked about these tutorials on GitHub. The most popular GitHub repos on GitHub are tutorial type repos. So it's an interesting play that's going on there.
Yeah, it doesn't run fast, for instance. So there's lots of things with caching that you could do, everything else. But if you just wanted to kick the tires on a model and try out a task, it's that's really what they're gearing that for.
Yeah. Last one I thought I'd bring up, not that real, I mean, not something I can really talk to because I haven't personally tried Claude Code out. I know, Dan, you are a big fan of it, and we've talked about it on previous office hours. There seems to be, love hate relationship with it, either that it's the best thing ever or not that impressive at all, depending on
It's
who
great
you're
for vibe
talking.
coding, I think, more less so than paired coding. Like Cursor is great because it's much more of a paired experience. You're able to see what the suggestions are in real time and accept or deny them. Whereas Claude Code, you just let it do its thing and hope it's right at the end.
So these are some best practices for Claude coding, which is the latter thing you were talking about, where you let it loose and build that thing of your dreams. Have you tried it on anything lately, Dan?
Not too much. I've been more hands-on with the code, so I don't want to just vibe code as much, but it's fun for personal projects to just see what it can do.
Yeah, that's fun.
Have an interesting aside. I was thinking a lot about this recently that vibe coding in particular, if you let or what, AI code generation in particular, especially in actual businesses, not just hobby projects like you're doing, really ups the need and requirement for real developers, quote unquote, to read and review a lot more code. Because often people do this vibe coding thing and then don't even read the code that's generated, and they just kind of like ship it and put it in a pull request. And so like it puts a lot more burden on on the people who are responsible for reviewing things as a gate to actually like spend time. You're now not giving the developer the benefit of the doubt because it's not actually the developer who did this. It's like some rogue process that you told to do something that may or may not have done it like in a sane way, and you now have to like catch all that in review and like really read a lot more of the code to understand how it works and all of that. And I think reading my own code that I've written has like before I submit it for a pull request often is how I really get a view on did I do this like well, how could this be refactored, and it helps me learn everything kind of at a high level of what I did and how it's going to work and everything when I submit it. And I feel like people are skipping that step, so they're not going to get that benefit anymore. So I don't know. It's not a well thought out thought. It's just like stream of consciousness right now that it's sort of shifting right the responsibility of getting code better instead of like shifting it left,
No, I relate with this because I on the one hand, I'm very bullish, very supportive of Cursor. Like, I mean, there are two sides of this, right? As a developer, you're probably very bullish on it because you can be kind of like the best version of yourself. You can move faster, saves you a lot of time. On the other hand, as a business owner, like the less time I have to pay to have somebody develop a solution, I like that. But you bring up a good point. Like when you're looking at those pull requests, and sometimes you're starting to see telltale, just like you can kind of see telltale writing signs of AI, you can see telltale writing signs of AI code. And like using the term, slop that's being thrown around a lot, there is a lot of slop. So I think the like you asked today, can we get CodeRabbit installed? It's interesting. It's kind of this agentic approach to, the developers are doing it their way with their agents and code, and then you have your other agents reviewing that code, and hopefully you have checks and balances, and it all evens out. Is that a pipe dream?
AI reviewing AI is the goal. And AI users too.
As long as they don't use the same model, then it's like reviewing your own code. I think that the thing with CodeRabbit is that I think it does a really good job of catching a lot of a lot of basic errors and not following patterns and doing a lot of things like that. So it helps, but it's still only a reduction of the effort that it will take to to review all of that code. So Yeah, I'm gonna pause there. And I think Michael, I saw your hand up, but then it went
Yeah,
back down.
Michael.
Did you have something to say?
Yeah, I was just gonna kind of piggyback on what you were saying about, I mean, what I'll call developer in the loop for AI generated code and offer like a testimony. I was working with Cursor AI, which is my preferred agentic editor of choice, and I was converting or translating a Java project into Python. And I gave it very explicit instructions of like, hey, here's the code, translate it for me, and have at it. And it did a wonderful job of translating the code, but when it looked at it from the project perspective, it looked at the POM XML file and converted it to a requirements.txt file, which was great, but it
Yeah.
put it in the wrong place. Because I was
Yeah.
working with a project structure where the source was below, like Java, you have like source directory, and then all the sources all the way down in here, then your POM's all the way at the top of the project. So it did something very similar for the Python code. So then when I went to go build the Python code to deploy to Lambda specifically, the requirements file was in the wrong place. So I'm like, the code compiles, it's clean, it works. But if I didn't know that that requirement file needed to be right next to the Python code, I wouldn't have understood. I was like, I would have said the AI was wrong, So it needs that human in the loop to really make it effective,
Still.
from end to end, I'll say that.
So, but yeah, I guess it is really, there's just not enough inputs, if you will, different these agents that are giving their critiques from different points of view with different prerogatives, if you will, the checks and balances. It's just like, this happens all the time with developers as well, human developers, right? Like, you want to get this thing done in the matter, in a short amount of time. You might, cut some corners just to get it done. And different, Matt likes to say Yagni, but
Yeah.
you ain't gonna need it until you do. I wanted to, Cyrus, you were saying that you've been going through the Quick Start project, and how's that been working? We were thinking of creating a cursor file. Actually, it's on Matt, or sorry, Dan's plate to create one, so you could do more of like what you're doing. Curious how that's going for you.
Yeah, so I would imagine about normal, considering we're stumbling through it just with the two of us right now. So we keep hitting kind of like a daily, oh, we're stuck here. We'll make a post and we'll get back to it tomorrow type of things. But we definitely like Cursor. I think we locked our state at some point, and Cursor helped us kind of find a quick command to get out of that. And I'm not having it actually edit my code at this point, more just using it as in like in IDE
Yeah.
expert to ask questions to. I think it would be great, especially if you can do, I know there's some dot cursor rules file and things like that that you can do a repo. That'd be really interesting to have that out of the
Okay, so
box.
you haven't gone down the route yet of tuning a cursor rules file. So that's what I have Dan looking into at some point. And it's just a positive feedback that you were kind of going in that direction, even though you haven't gotten as far as the rules file.
Yeah.
Cool.
We'll let you know. We'll be in constant. You'll see us on the forums.
Dan, it's almost like could we use Claude Code combined with a quick start and actually brings up the infrastructure for you too?
Yes, I 100% think that we could do that. It would just tickle. It would be interesting. We need to get our testing in place first, make testing entirely robust, and then we can see how much we can shift to AI.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. All right, so that's the end of the topics that I had on the agenda today. Any questions, any other announcements or interesting things you saw this week or questions we can discuss today? Sergey asks, has anyone used Paladoc? Peladoc, I don't know how to say it. I've not heard of it, so definitely not me.
That looks like the Spanish paella duck.
Yeah. Is that what it is? AI first development framework. Huh. Oh, this is a framework optimized for Cursor.
I think this is a framework of how to locally. There's a few of these that are popped up. I think I haven't read this. I don't know this one, but I'm surmising from looking at this that there's a bunch of these frameworks that have popped up to create local memory, or basically of what's happened. So it follows a specific order where you have the LLMs help you create a task list of things to do and break them out and everything else. And as it works on that, it updates those documents to let you know that, you know, where it is and where its work has been, so that it can read it. Both future developers and future agents can read like what's been done so far, so it can get a better understanding of the context of the repo without having to actually read like all the code and just understand it from the code. So it's
Okay.
like user stories and like that kind of thing. So
What was that
I've seen a
software
few
that
other
was
frameworks like that.
that?
I think it's like this.
You were talking about your, or was that, I forget if it was on Office Hours or somewhere else that you had tried.
Think it was somewhere else, but maybe I remember talking about it. I just don't remember where I was. Yeah.
Membank is apparently another one, Sergey says.
Yeah. I think one of them is only for what the heck's that other Windsurf. I've seen another one for Windsurf, and I've seen another one that only works with certain other things. But I think this whole idea of creating like a local memory of things that you've worked on in your repository is catching on because I've seen a ton of frameworks pop up that do this.
Very interesting. So, as a layman here, is this a little bit like also how ChatGPT has a memory? So it kind of knows that works in like snapshots of things that you've said, or but so it's not always starting from scratch. This seems like it's doing that, but maybe a little bit more prescriptively of things that were done.
Yeah, I think it's more of a way to get the context. So like there's a shopping basket page, and then there's there's a Stripe service, and then there's a database table that has Stripe things in it. And I guess you could read all of that code and put together logically that a shopping cart was implemented. But it's a lot easier for the agent if you see that there was a thing that says, as a user, I want to be able to add items to my shopping cart. And as a user, I want to be able to check out. And I'm just using one that I've seen
Yeah.
that's like user story based. And the idea is that it writes, you see the user stories, and then there's a history file that says, I cursor implemented these three files so that I could basically achieve this user story. And then the LLM can very quickly read just those four or five files and understand what was implemented and why. So when you say, hey, I want to update my shopping cart experience so that we can also support coupons or whatever, it now doesn't have to like read the entire code base to try to figure out like what is the shopping cart
Yeah.
and
It
all
doesn't
of
have to
that. It
start from
has this
scratch
like
to.
more like memory and context about why and how things have been done. So that's my only slightly better than layman's description of how the whole thing works. I haven't really dug into how it works like at the model layer, like how they do this, but it's kind of like the idea behind that. Or like, AIs often go off on like, we use certain patterns for certain reasons, and then all of a sudden they just stop using that pattern. Where if they read this thing, they realize why you're using that pattern and they continue to stay on it, those types of things. So anyway, those are my understandings of how it works.
That's helpful though. Thanks. Yeah, I got a lot more to learn on this, that's for sure. And it's moving so fast, with so many smart people, I think, working on it. All right, any other questions we can talk about here? The open-ended portion of office hours. It's just an opportunity to get the input from 16 other people on the call here, from various, backgrounds and experience.
I have random questions about MCP. Like, what is the, and I've seen Goose. I haven't really tapped into it. I think I just installed the Goose CLI today. I haven't installed the desktop. But what's the hello world for MCP? Like, if I want to develop my own server or expose a tool to an agent or some agentic process runner like Goose or even like Cursor, I think you can do the same thing with Cursor, like define your MCP servers and tools and everything. Yeah, just bouncing it off the congregation. What's the hello world for it?
Jeremy, you've spent some time with this, no?
Yeah, so I was actually gonna get the actual quick tutorial that I had gone off of with Pocket. Although it really, so first things first, Anthropic really started that whole thing with MCP. So you should absolutely read up their docs on why they did it, what's going on with it. It's different than a lot of other approaches, which have a lot more folks behind it. Such as agent to agent and other things. That said, right, there's simple sort of examples that come with I'll just get the actual repo here and I'll put it into the Zoom chat. So like for instance, there's Pocket's own code base for it. They actually link to a little blog page, which is here. They go over it in a still opinionated way, but they let their bias show, which is kind of nice. The way that I like to think of it, you're building a sort of graph of decisions. And if that's, in the client, you're asking your agent to first look at what my tools are. Okay, decide which tool to use. Now use that tool, kind of repeat, and you're cycling through this process of using tools to make decisions and then eventually come to some final state where you summarize the results. So if you're really wanting to write an agent, then, or I'm sorry, a client for MCP, that's what you're looking at. If you're trying to just make the server, then you don't need to do any of that. Instead, the server is just expose a few functions, describe them, and offer up some prompts that help the agent use your tool. So, in that case, you might just make a calculator that has add, subtract, multiply, divide. That's what they, I think, go through in the example. And then describe each one of those in simple terms. And then your job is kind of done in terms of writing the functions. And basically, the prompts help if your model doesn't know function calling. And function calling is one of those things that you can usually hint your way through models that don't know what to do with it. Things like Claude already have that built in. OpenAI already has that. I kind of talked all around the topic. Is there anything like, say, are you trying to add a new server or a new client?
You know, I don't know, is the short answer. I'm looking at MCP or maybe even agents as a way to process complex workflows. So, I mean, I'm a big proponent for automation, and I have workflows that are fragmented where the manual steps are, you go to the website, you download this thing, you process that thing, which is a manual step. I wouldn't want an agent for AI to do that. But then when you're done with the processing thing, and this is all media processing, basically, upload it to another site. And on that site, it does its thing. It has a few exports that are different formats, JSON, DocX, SRT, that type of stuff. And I
That
want,
does sound more like agent to agent. Not to
it would
stop you
be
too
cool if
soon.
it could be automated. Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
I mean, agent to agent is probably more of what you might want to look into. I'll give you an example of me when I did some MCP stuff. I did it was really quick and easy. I just added a quick command to Atmos. This is what I was hacking on a weekend to just allow a agent to do Atmos validate. That was all it would do, was just run Atmos validate. I later kind of customized it to give more context around different errors, so that the AI agent knew more of what to do with different problems. But after I did that, all I had to do was, in Goose or Cursor, you just tell it how to run Atmos in that server mode, and then it just knows how to validate your stacks. And that was like, I want to say less than an hour to write that. And I was already automating different pieces, so I could just say, hey, could you please just adjust these two or three things, and just see how how Cursor did it, and Goose did it as well. It was a nice productivity boost. But if you're talking about something, I think a little bit deeper here, where there's sort of bigger context changes. So you were talking about scripts, files in one location, and really, you have to remember that context is the biggest tax you can give onto an AI. When it has to hold a lot in its head, it tends to get spottier on what it chooses to do. So really, the min-max here is to try to pick a series of prompts that allow you to minimize the context that the AI has to hold on to. So agent to agent is kind of nice that way, because you say, okay, I'm going to have an agent over here that just knows about this part of the problem, like, say, how these files function in my architecture. And then you might have another agent over here that's trying to resolve some sort of conflict with those particular files. And then they should just have conversation between each other to resolve a topic. And you might have a ringleader above, if you will, that's guiding that process. So three agents to do that. And then they all know very little in terms of the overall context to get a job done. But that's, looking at it from an agent to agent way of coding. And that is sophisticated, I'll be completely honest. Not really a weekend endeavor, but you can do it.
Totally makes sense. I mean, I have seen mentions of the overseer or the controller, however you want to refer to the top level agent that's kind of controlling the sub level agents that do a very specific task. So yeah, thanks for reminding me of that. That may be the better approach for the particular workflow that I'm thinking about.
And they have an example. Again, I'll just throw you the Pocket article again. There's you can probably go through them yourself. I just for the sake of everybody following along after this, there's their multi-agent example and sort of how you can use that to springboard into creating a few small mundane things. I think MVP is usually where I stop with a lot of these, and usually it's a lot of fun if you just don't worry about expanding it and sharing it with other people, because it is tricky to finesse those prompts. And using a tool like Plainview is like where I would start with something like doing multi-agent, right? Is can you see what the thinking approach of each LLM was and see where they went wrong when things fail? And then, intentionally make difficult prompts to just see how rugged your approach is. And so that observability part is what really helps you iterate faster on designing agents.
Got it. Yeah, thanks for that.
And any final questions for today? Well, that about wraps it up for today. We'll be posting a recording to our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse where you can find it. Post it in a couple hours. If you're interested in seeing if Cloud Posse can help you at your organization, go to cloudposse.com/meet and book a meeting with me directly. If you want to attend Office Hours Live, just go to cloudposse.com/office hours to subscribe. We also post a podcast, which is just the audio version of our office hours. So if you want to listen to it that way, go ahead and go to podcast.cloudposse.com. We have a Slack community where we discuss all these things as well at slack.cloudposse.com. Thanks everyone for your time today. We'll be in touch.